Bankless Nation, is the third week of August. Time for the Bankless Weekly Roll-Up. David, we got to get to this question first. This is a meme I saw on Twitter that I think encapsulate what everyone is feeling right now. What if 124,000 Bitcoin was the cycle top and there won't be an alt season? And this is a picture of a bald Wojak just lying in bed thinking about this question in his McDonald's
wearing a McDonald's
attire.
T-shirt. Yeah, yes. His McDonald's polo. I mean, I think it's a good question, because questions like this, I think we should always be asking ourselves. To me, this is a sign of market rationality.
Are you like laying up at night thinking about this?
We are not guaranteed an alt season. We are never guaranteed an alt season. And yeah, the fact that like this is a question that the market is pondering and turning over, I think is healthy.
You think it's a good question?
Yeah.
Yeah. It allows us to not feel entitled as investors to question our assumptions. Although this is a depiction of someone in a McDonald's shirt, which implies he's like going and getting a job and he's deeply worried.
At
he's
McDonald's,
spending all night thinking about this question. Do you think that gets to unhealthy territory?
I mean, at some point, crypto Twitter memes are guaranteed to come out of the mental health asylum that is crypto Twitter.
Well, we're going to try to answer that question the best of our ability. Do I buy the dip or do I sell everything? The two extremes of that spectrum. And we'll give our takes on the question. Also, we've got 30 peak bull market signals. And the
not
question
one,
is...
Not
yeah,
two.
30.
Not three. Not four. But 30 signals.
And the question is, okay, these are the top signals. Which of those 30 top signals are flashing red at the moment? So David and I are going to get into that too.
ETH ETFs continue to keep smashing records. So at least we have some good strength signals despite some red on the market. Tom Lee bought another $1 to $2 billion of ETH. Jesus.
Yeah.
And then Saylor wants to mint more shares of MicroStrategy to buy more Bitcoin, because that's what he wants. There was a small there's a small amount of Bitcoin buying this week from Saylor, but not a lot. But he is getting ready to do an ATM, an at-the-market sale of MicroStrategy. All of this and more. Ryan, why is this episode coming out on Thursday?
Oh, yeah, that's right. So this is a day early. So we'll package it. This is a gift to Bankless. We're doing this a day early, so you get on Thursday rather than Friday. But the real reason for that is because David has taken a little trip. And we never miss a roll-up.
Yeah.
It was just not an option for us to record on Thursday, put it out on Friday this week, because David is going to Burning Man once again, aren't you, David? So you're hitting the road.
It's not a mountain trip, so don't bid.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Burning Man trip.
This is your second Burning Man, and I can't recall the first time. What happened? Did anything good happen in crypto while you were gone?
Yeah, actually. XRP won their case against the SEC, which cleared the path for the... Yeah, while I was gone at Burning Man. So even though I wasn't on a mountain, I was gone.
Yeah.
And we had the court case that happened that cleared the way for the approval of the Bitcoin and Ether ETFs.
So you defeated
some
bosses
there. So that was pretty good, actually. That was pretty good.
Burning Man style, it would be something weird like XRP. That's what you affect in the markets, right? So it's going to be something equally weird, right? Okay, well, so David is out, and I will be substituting with, who am I doing this with next week?
You're with Haseeb next week.
Of course.
Yep.
Fantastic.
Yep.
So we'll be doing that next week. Also, David, we got to thank our sponsor this week of the Bankless Weekly Rollup, the Ronin Chain, okay? And they've got some big news that they're announcing they want you to hear about. What are they up to?
Not just the Ronin Chain, but now the incoming Ronin Ethereum Layer 2. They're coming home to Ethereum. Ronin is an EVM chain, and now they are transitioning to becoming an Ethereum Layer 2. So what does this mean for Ronin? They are getting up to 12x faster transactions. They're getting lower costs because they can just borrow security and decentralization from Ethereum. The RON token will remain the gas token of the Ronin Layer 2. But overall, Ronin is just getting an upgrade. EVM chains like to aggregate around the EVM shelling point, which is Ethereum. Ryan, did you know this? $4.5 billion in NFT volume on Ronin chain, around 30 million wallets. It's one of the most active chains out there. It's actually more active than the Ronin chain, which is the home of Axie Infinity, which
sparked off. Yeah, you should say that. This is like
so
the gaming chain.
The gaming chain.
Yes.
Yeah. And during the height of the 2021 mania, where Axie Infinity was just dominating, Ronin chain actually has more activity on the chain today than it had back then in 2021 during the height of Axie Infinity. That is a fun fact. Yeah. And so Ronin is looking to move just beyond gaming and position itself as a gamification engine for various types of consumer and Web3 apps. The transition to becoming a layer two is scheduled for Q1 or Q2 of 2026, but nonetheless, the chain is up and running today. So you can download the Ronin wallet and get a taste of what is, I'll kind of call it like on-chain Nintendo, a gaming studio Yeah. With a variety of games that all kind of like interrelate with each other. Bankless.cc/Ronin Wallet is what you want.
Welcome home to the Ronin chain. That's a big move. Yeah. That's pretty bullish, the L2 roadmap as well. All right, David, let's get to something not so bullish. Feeling some pain in the markets this week. And maybe we'll start with some tweets from Joe Weisenthal. We're talking about the NASDAQ. So that's the ticker is QQQ for the NASDAQ index, having its worst 2 days since April 7th. All right, so some bad days for QQQ on the week, and maybe this accounts for some of the broader selling that we've seen into crypto. We'll get into some of those numbers in just a minute. Why is this activity happening? We've got a couple of reasons that we can maybe assign it to. Of course, maybe this is narrative following price. You could take that interpretation, but still, there are some things that happen on the week from a narrative perspective. What are they?
I feel like their investors have chalked it up to about two reasons. The first being the AI bubble kind of feels skittish, and then also macro worries. We'll go dive into each one of those. But I'll just kind of say markets climb a wall of worry. And this is what this looks like to me. Like the S&P, nonetheless, up to like 4 days ago, was at an all-time high. Same with crypto. And there's macro fears. There is economy weakness fears. But this is just, to me, this feels very par for the course. And so I'm not overly scared right now. The first one that we'll talk about, the AI bubble. One of the big factors is that just Wall Street's worry is that the value coming out of all of these AI companies, OpenAI, Anthropic, all this stuff, and especially NVIDIA, which is also having its worst 2 days since April, is just like the productivity coming out of those things is not worth the CapEx going into those things. The costs are not actually resulting in material gains. And so there was a Sam Altman publicly stated that last week that he believes the AI sector is in a bubble. So Sam Altman says AI is in a bubble.
Yeah, actually, I dug into this to actually see whether this was a headline or what he actually said. And this was an interview on The Verge. So it's all posted here. He said this. The question to him was, are we in a phase where investors as a whole are overexcited about AI? And Sam goes, my opinion is yes. And he went on further. When bubbles happen, smart people get overexcited about a kernel of truth. If you look at most of the bubbles in history, like the tech bubble, there really was a thing. Tech was really important. The internet was a really big deal, but people got overexcited. And then he said that he's seeing some insane valuations, like, you know, three and or four people with an idea receiving funding at massively high valuations. So he actually did use the B word, bubble, which is kind of interesting because OpenAI, of course, is like one of the leaders of the pack in this whole AI expansion thing. You'd think that would be against his interests here, but he used those words.
Yeah. Also, I think I saw OpenAI stock, like private shares of OpenAI stock got approved to sell for a minimum of a $500 billion valuation. So OpenAI being valued at $500 trillion. I mean, like, it'd be
still doing okay.
Still doing great, but like also like, if we're talking about a bubble, let's talk about the $500 trillion valuation of a company that just started turning a profit like a couple years ago.
Well, maybe he is talking about that too. What's really interesting is AI kind of is the stock market right now. AI kind of is the economy in the US right now. It's responsible for about 0.5% of GDP, and all the CapEx that's going into data centers and energy around AI, like that's the big story of the fuel for S&P, for NASDAQ, for this entire economy. So if this
NVIDIA,
is a .com.
NVIDIA is 14% of the NASDAQ.
That's crazy, right?
Yeah.
And that's just NVIDIA. The other like big tech companies are right there with it. And so this is the driver of the economy right now. And so if this is a bubble, if this does something like .com, okay, that's what investors are worried about. And this is Sam Altman saying, bubbly. There was also this MIT report. Do you see this? I haven't read the whole report, which I mean to, but the MIT report said 95% of generative AI pilots at companies are failing to produce some sort of profit. So we're trying all these AI tools. We're trying to, you know, get this diffused within our companies in the US, but they're not returning that investment, at least not yet. And so the market looks at these things and gets a little skittish. It's a sell signal.
Yeah, I think this is healthy. We don't really know how AI is going to penetrate into society. Like maybe AI more selectively benefits the margins and allows more people to become entrepreneurs and build startups with fewer employees and get to market faster. Maybe that's how AI penetrates. Maybe it doesn't penetrate into like large enterprises and streamlines their workflows because there's just so much incumbent bureaucracy in those systems that we don't really know how to make AI work in there. Like we don't really know the answers to these questions. But overall, I do enjoy somewhat material pullbacks across the board. Because that, again, markets climb a wall of worry. Without having pullbacks, that's when you should get really worried.
Do you know what's funny is this is kind of a pullback for ants, though, David. Look at this, man. Yeah. This is the QQQ chart, okay? Yeah. We are all the way, we teleported all the way back to August 4th pricing on the NASDAQ. Mm. Not even a month, man. Mm. Just a few weeks.
Not even a month?
Look, August 4th.
I mean, like, crypto investors are like feeling bad. It's like, is it all over? And I go look at ETH price and like, bro, we're at $4,200.
Yeah. Okay. But
there's two. Yeah. There's so the double whammy. It's like maybe the aligning of the double whammy is worthwhile. So the macro worries are the second one. Investors are worried about stagflation due to the combination of the weak jobs report that's come in over the last 2 weeks and the high PPI numbers that we talked about last week. Jobs data starting to look very weak. Inflation seeming to be sticky and hot, more sticky and hot than previously understood to be. And that combination of inflation spiking with weaker jobs data is just putting the Fed in a tight place. The Fed has the dual mandate of stability in jobs and also manage inflation. And they are just being placed in a particularly difficult spot to do both of those things. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell will deliver a keynote address at the annual Jackson Hole event on Friday, this coming Friday, the 22nd, at a crucial time as the economy anticipates the central bank's next interest rate cut and as his tenure will at the helm of the Fed will wind down. So this incoming speech from Fred Jerome Powell might be his last since his tenure ends in May of 2026. And so this will be his last big speech, apparently. And so the incoming September 17th is the next big Fed meeting that happens alongside the FOMC. So Powell and the Fed is going to present the summary of economic projections, basically like forward guidance for the economy. And so the FOMC meeting and the next Fed September 17th meeting happening at the same time, these combinations of these two events usually coincides with a Fed decision to make just bigger announcements about any potential change in a rate cut policy. Ryan's got the poly market pulled up ever since that the PPI numbers came in last week. I think that's what the change in those graphs look like. All of a sudden, the numbers about what the Fed is going to do has jumped around quite a bit. 70% chance, according to poly market, of a 25 bips decrease. That didn't used to be the case. It used to be pretty tied between 25% bips decrease and no change. So right now, 70%, 25% bip decrease, and 30% no change. But now the decrease has taken the lead with the high inflation numbers. People are worried about if Powell does not cut rates, then Trump is just going to get very angry and become a bull in a China shop. And so that's potentially also a fear. But overall, between like AI being skitterish, stagflation worries, job market worries, inflation worries, and then Trump being a bull in a China shop, I think people are just like, scary. And we are seeing a pullback.
And I think this is mostly narrative following price, right? Because price pullback, and then we're like, oh, you remember those things that were scary that were lingering out there? Those were the reasons.
Yep.
And it's the same things that we've been talking about that, you know, of course, if AI is a bubble, that, you know, things will be bad. But I don't see that that's the case, at least at this point in time. Anyway, we'll give our takes on whether this is a buy the dip moment or whether you should sell everything a little bit later in the episode. Let's talk about the price of our beloved crypto assets on the week. Unfortunately, they are down. Give us the bad news for Bitcoin.
Bitcoin down 6.5% to $113,600. Ether doing something similar, down 10% to $4,200. Yet nonetheless, over the last week, ETH ETFs have attracted $3 billion of net inflows. Okay, well, this is for August at large, so for the entire month. So Bitcoin attracted rounding up to $1 billion during that same time period. Ether, $3 billion. So a 3-to-1 increase.
3-to-1 for ETH over Bitcoin in terms of ETF flows for August?
In dollar terms, yeah.
Wow.
We did see some outflows this week, and so $422 million came out of the ETH ETFs in the last 7 days. $650 million came out of the Bitcoin ETFs over the last 7 days. But nonetheless, it's still a fantastic August so far.
This is a Hildabi metric here. At current pace, the percent of ETH in ETFs will exceed Bitcoins in September. Okay, that's at current pace, but and which has been ferocious. But look at this. We already have about just over 5% of all ETH supply in Ethereum ETFs. Bitcoin is 6.3%, looking like 6.4%. we keep moving like this, there'll be more ETH in ETH ETFs than there is Bitcoin and Bitcoin ETFs.
I'm trying to understand what this means. Like, is higher better? Is lower better? Is it kind of neutral?
It's just, it represents, I think, institutional capital flows for sure in a big way.
Yeah.
So that's good. That's good. I mean, if you start to get like, you know, institutions have like, you know, 20, 30%.
More than 30% starts to really materially scare me.
Yeah. But I feel like we're at safe numbers. And the thing that we've been looking for, that ETH bulls have been looking for, is like where the institutional flows into Ether. And we're starting to see them in a big way. I want to zoom out on these charts. So we're talking about, you know, the 7-day and the weekly, and Bitcoin's down, ETH is down. If you kind of zoom out, both Bitcoin and Ether have had different months. So if you're a Bitcoin holder, right, you are like, you're feeling on the monthly, you're like down on the month. Like this month, or the last 30 days, we were at 118, and now we're back in the 112 range, right? 112.
Can we go to 3 months?
Range.
Let's look at 3 months. I like to see
Let's look at three months. So we're still up on 3 months for Bitcoin.
That is flat.
That is flat.
It's green, but it's flat.
It's green, but flat. Now let's look at Ether. It's a difference. So this is, we talked about the 7-day. This is the month. Uh-huh. You're still up on the month. So in the last 30 days,
Month's looking good.
Yeah, it would, about 30 days ago, price of ETH was 3,800, and now we're above 4K, of course. The 3 month, though, looks real good.
We were down in the dumps. Yeah.
We were 2.6K, right? Yeah. Right? And now we're above 4K. So ETH holders feeling better about the momentum here than Bitcoin, which has been relatively flat. That's going to show up in the ETH Bitcoin ratio, too. What's that on the week?
That is right, 0.037. I think we just like grazed 0.04. We never really crossed it. 0.037 is where we are now. Still looking to climb up to that 0.05, 0.06 range before anything, I think, needs to be reconsidered about the ETH BTC ratio.
And total crypto market cap is down below 4 trillion, right?
We are healthily below 4 trillion at 3.9 trillion. Yeah. I think the new all-time high for the total crypto market cap is like 4.2 something.
4.2, which we hit second week of August.
Yep. And now we are at 3.9. So,
all right.
Yeah. I think, like, just summing it all up, right? Like, you're not supposed to feel good the entire bull market. Like, you need to have moments of fear and uncertainty and doubt in your mind.
Yeah.
Before it resumes.
Yeah.
And the people that, you know, have diamond hands, the people that hold, that have some level of stoicism about them, get rewarded.
Yeah.
If it goes back up, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, some people are going to get shaken out and they're not going to make it. And that's just how it goes. Or some people are just ahead of the curve and they get shaken out because there's actual real fear. We don't really know. Well, and I'm not being helpful at all.
I think that is somewhat helpful, because I think what you're indicating is, like, we're going to talk about top signals coming up next. But what you're talking about is, if you're feeling too good about these markets, like they can't go down, if you're feeling like a genius in these markets, right, that just like everything's unstoppable, that's probably a top signal. And I'm not seeing crypto markets feeling like that right now. They're constantly questioning. Yeah. We're in the stage of, here's the stage that we're in. Are we really in a bull market? Or is 124K the top, and there's going to be no ETH season, really? There's going to be no alt season. You're questioning it, okay?
Right.
And you don't question things. When, like, previously, in previous cycles, you're not questioning things. You are drunk, okay?
Yeah. You're winding up leverage at the top.
Yes, or at least many people are. Anyway, we'll talk about that next, because we got Tom Lee buying 1 to 2 billion in ETH. We got him trying to catch Michael Saylor, it feels like. But MNAV premiums, remember the MNAV premiums, David? Those are going down. So some people are saying, is the treasury meta over? And then more broadly, we got to talk about this. Was this the cycle top? Should you buy the dip? We'll get into those top cycle indicators, all that and more. But before we do, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible, including Uniswap, browser wallet, mobile wallet, the best place to trade, to do DeFi. Go check out the Unichain L2 as well. Let's hear from Uniswap.
Ethereum's Layer 2 universe is exploding with choices. But if you're looking for the best place to park and move your tokens, make your next stop Unichain. First, liquidity. Unichain hosts the most liquid Uniswap V4 deployment on any Layer 2, giving you deeper pools for flagship pairs like ETH-USDC. More liquidity means better prices, less slippage, and smoother swaps, exactly what traders crave. The numbers back it up. Unichain leads all Layer 2s in total value locked for Uniswap V4. And it's not just deep. It's fast and fully transparent, purpose-built to be the home base for DeFi. DeFi, and cross-chain liquidity. When it comes to costs, Unichain is a no-brainer. Transaction fees come in about 95% cheaper than Ethereum mainnet, slashing the price of creating or accessing liquidity. Want to stay in the loop on Unichain? Visit unichain.org or follow at Unichain on X for all the updates. Imagine a world where traditional finance meets the power of blockchain seamlessly. That's what Mantle is pioneering with Blockchain for Banking, a revolutionary new category at the intersection of TradFi and Web3. At the heart is UR, the world's first money app built fully on-chain. It gives you a Swiss IBAN account, blending fiat currencies like the euro, the Swiss franc, the United States dollar, or the renminbi with crypto, all in one place. Enjoy real-world usability and blockchain's trust and programmability. Transactions post directly to the blockchain, compatible with TradFi rails, and packed with integrated DeFi futures. UR transforms Mantle Network into the ultimate platform for on-chain financial services, unifying payments, trading, and assets like the MI4, the METH protocol, and Function's FBTC. Backed by developer grants, ecosystem incentives, and top distribution through the UR app, reward stations, and Bybit launch pool. For MNT holders, every economic activity in UR drives value back to you, embodying the entire stack and future growth of this super app ecosystem. Follow Mantle on X at Mantle_official for the latest updates on blockchain for banking. That's x.com/Mantle_official.
The treasury companies keep buying, but that MNAV premium is losing its premium status. So the question is the treasury meta over? Let's talk about some big things that happened this week first. Bitmine became the second largest crypto treasury. Okay, not just ETH treasury. They've been the first for a number of weeks, but the second largest crypto treasury, like completely. So just behind MicroStrategy, of course, is the first. It's going to be hard to catch Michael Saylor. They overtook Mara Holdings, which was a Bitcoin treasury, the second largest Bitcoin treasury, and they are now in second place with about $6.5 billion worth of Ether, primarily. You can actually track
one
this.
1.25% of the total ETH supply.
Yeah, 1.25%. I mean, he's getting there. He's getting like over the last 50 days or so. I mean, he is 1.26% of his 5% total. He is chomping, buying that Ether. My question is, are we really going to let him? Depending on the price.
Yeah, I mean, like, Tom Lee, slow down, man. Like, I want this to, like, be a long-term thing. Like, if you just win, like, next month, like, it's not really as fun.
Well, I think he's in a hurry to buy it under 5K, and it feels like crypto's going to let him. Yeah. Like, he's probably going to stack 10 billion in Ether under 5K, and the market's just going to let him do that.
I mean, like, I kept on asking the same question every single time I saw Michael Saylor buy a bajillion dollars of Bitcoin every single month. I'm like, where the fuck does the money come from?
That's one of the questions. So that's one of my big questions is, like, where's the money coming from? And Tom Lee, maybe we could go scan some SEC filings or something like that. But when we talked to him, he was, you know, kind of private about that, somewhat secretive.
Yeah, I asked him twice. And I was like, Tom Lee, what's the strategy? How do you use velocity and liquidity and all that stuff to get more ETH on the balance sheet? And he's like, David, stop asking me this question. That question is
inappropriate.
That's an inappropriate question.
God bless him, though. I mean, he's doing, look at this. This is crypto treasury companies. This blue line here is Ether in terms of percent supply of the network. This orange line is Bitcoin. Look at Ether ratcheting up. We are almost at Bitcoin levels in as a percent of the network in treasury. So Bitcoin level is almost 3.5%. ETH has climbed all the way up from 0% in June all the way to almost 2.5% of total Ether supply in treasury companies. So this buying is happening at a frenetic pace. But my other question about this is, like, why isn't it moving price more?
Yeah.
Do you have an explainer for that?
I have a partial explainer for that. One of them is Joe Lubin's SBET and Andrew Keys's the Ether machine.
Sure.
Like, each of those contributed their own personal Ether into those treasury companies.
As part of the initial raise, the pipe raise.
And that is showing up in this chart, in this line that's going up into the right here.
Some of the early stuff.
Some of it. Well, I mean, like, Joe Lubin and Andrew Keys are very large Ether holders previously. And so there was the hundreds of millions of dollars that is their own Ether that got contributed into these Ether treasury companies is not net new buying. There's no new money coming in to buy that Ether. They already owned it, and now it's showing up in a chart that we call the ETH treasury company chart.
Okay.
And so that at least is not actual buy pressure. It's just like saying Ether getting wrapped into wrapped Ether is not going to move but the ETH price.
That explains some of it. It doesn't explain all. Like, look at these Tom Lee purchases, man. He's almost, yeah. This is $6.3 billion in a dollar reserve. He bought another 370K last week. That's, what's that? You know, $1 to $2 billion worth of ETH? He just did that last week. Oh, and then he bought another $1 to $2 billion the week before. And then the week before that, too. Like, that's a lot of net new buying pressure. That's not all existing ETH pipe funding.
Yeah. There's like other theories about this that I think are unsubstantiated because no one really knows, because these are all kind of black boxes at the end of the day. But like some people have pointed out to like some of these treasury companies are doing like paper ETH, not true ETH. And so they're having Ether as kind of their denominator and they're using financial derivatives to accumulate more like paper ETH. And so with ETH goes up, they have exposure to it, but it's not actually true vanilla spot ETH. But no one really knows. No one really knows.
I mean, this is buy pressure. It's like a simple explainer is there's still people selling ETH. There's still enough sell pressure to kind of neutralize all the buy pressure. And it's not just BitMine and Tom Lee, of course, like SharpLink Gaming, SBET. Big week last week too. I mean, on August 17th this week, they bought 75K ETH. That's after on August 10th, they bought 83K ETH. Their total right now, SBET, almost 740,000 ETH. So $3.1 billion in ETH. So they're buying lots too.
Yeah. Either there is, you know, a commensurate amount of sell pressure or the supply of ETH on the secondary market is truly drying up. And it will do one of its things that it did. It's done it twice now, where it went from $1,300 to $2,500 in two days.
Yep.
And then it went from $2,500 to $4,500 in like 2 weeks. And then it goes flat and everyone's like, why isn't it going
over?
Up? And then it goes up at 2x's in like 3 days because all the supply runs out.
Yep. And people are trying to trade that, you know, they're like, okay, I'm like bearish and try to trade that. Just stay in the market. Yeah. I think that could be the simplest Occam's razor explanation.
Yeah, I mean, we have two data points that's how it's happened. Actually,
that's how it always happens in crypto, right?
It's always, yeah.
Oh, it seems like it's barely going up. All this like, you know, bullish energy, all this buy pressure, and then suddenly it teleports up. Step function change, super volcano explosion. I think that's my base case for ETH at this point, but absent another explainer. Some other news on the week when it comes to ETH treasuries, the company ETHZilla, they used to be a different ticker, ATNF, was like a life sciences ticker. They are now officially ETHZ. So if you want to find ETHZilla.
Great ticker.
Yeah.
Great ticker. I love it.
ETHZ.
You know, all right. The ETHZilla name is kind of growing on me.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch the Rugrats?
Yeah, of course I did. Tommy.
You remember Reptar?
Yeah, I remember Reptar. Oh my God, that's been a long time.
Yeah, every time I see ETHZilla, I just think of Reptar just like
just
eating
chomping
up all the ETH. Reptar!
That's like a, that's a throwback, man. They're number five, by the way. So not to be dismissed, they've got about $400 million worth of ETH, about 100K worth of ETH, and they are chomping it Reptar style.
Reptar.
So yeah, we got that going on again.
But of course, the ETH treasury companies are not the only people putting crypto on their balance sheet. The OG, MicroStrategy, is buying once again. They bought 430 Bitcoin, a modest amount in MicroStrategy terms.
Yeah.
They spent about $51 million near the Bitcoin all-time high price for an average purchase price of around $119,000. MicroStrategy stock owners didn't really like it, partly because it was just a small amount of Bitcoin in the grand scheme of things. But also, the bigger story is after MSCR fell 8%, it fell 8% after the company indicated that it would lower its restrictions on issuing more shares. And it's actually interesting to note that MicroStrategy has not been doing this as of late. Michael Saylor originally promised that he wouldn't mint new shares of MicroStrategy unless the trading price was at least 2.5 MNAV. So 2.5,
explain
2.5 a market cap of MicroStrategy versus the actual amounts of Bitcoins that they hold.
Yep.
And so he would only mint new shares above 2.5x. He's reneging on that. He's going back on that and saying, just kidding, I'm going to do that. MicroStrategy is currently trading at 1.6 MNAV. And I was like, 1.6 MNAV is good. Like, that's healthy.
It's still good.
You have
but
a lot of premium to be able to juice to just buy more Bitcoin.
Sure.
And so, I mean, this is very rational. Like if Michael Saylor says, hey, MSTR holders, I'm going to dilute you to buy more Bitcoin, makes sense that MicroStrategy goes down by 8%.
Yeah, I mean, that's what ETH treasury companies are doing primarily. I mean, they have some debt instruments, but primarily they're doing it with these ATM purchases, which is basically anytime MNAV premium gets like higher than, you know, and they decide to mint more shares in order to buy more of Ether. Yeah. And the thing, though, with MicroStrategy, though, is Michael Saylor said he's not going to do that below 2.5. Mm-hmm. And now he has changed his mind. At 1.6, he's still minting new shares. So there's some anger at this. So he tweeted this out, this new guidance. You know, here's a Twitter account. I've been a holder of MSTR since August 2020. I've held through the bears, bulls, and splits. But until today, this is now, I will be taking some profit at this point. There's too many question marks, red flags about what you're doing that making me feel a bit unsettled for the first time. So it's just a little bit of maybe promises broken for MSTR holders. But Michael Saylor just wants more Bitcoin, right? And this is a way to do it. But doesn't this indicate that some of his debt instruments, that kind of ammo in the toolkit, is probably running out?
Milking the MNAV premium is like kind of the last thing you do. Not to say that it's a bad thing to do, but it's kind of the last thing. It's the thing you want to preserve the most, which is the MNAV value of the equity over the actual assets that you hold. If you can access the debt markets, if you can access credit, then you should do that first before issuing shares. And so there's like, Michael Saylor has made a bunch of tranches. He has all of these like fixed income coupons that he's issued that pay out 10%, and he can issue those without issuing new equity to buy more Bitcoin. And he has done that to great effect. To me, saying that like, yeah, we're actually going to go in and mint new shares indicates that like the rest of the tranches have kind of dried up. And now he's going back to the last source, the kind of the final backstop to squeeze out any sort of liquidity premium that he can get. And I mean, it's actually bullish that he hasn't been doing this up to this point. The ETH treasury companies, smaller as they are and more new as they are, they don't have the same level of debt instrument optionality that Michael Saylor has. And so they like, if you're a brand new ETH treasury company, you only have the MNAV as a source to squeeze juice out of to put more ETH on the balance sheet. I think it's like the hopes of people like Tom Lee, Joe Lubin to be able to access the credit market as they get the market caps larger. But MicroStrategy market cap is massive by comparison. I don't know it off the top of my head, but like tens of billions, if not 100.
Oh yeah. Did I see like 60-70 billion, excuse me, at some point in time? I think it's in that range still.
And BitMine and SBET are in the single digit billions.
Yeah, he's still saying though that he's going to buy more Bitcoin, right? So if you're bullish Bitcoin, he's still buying it. He's just doing it with the MNAV premium. Actually, this is interesting. Yep. A reporter asked Michael Saylor what he thinks, because some of the story of why the convertible debt type instruments are drying up might be because ETH treasury companies are snapping some of it up. He was asked what he thinks about quote unquote altcoin treasuries that are spinning up right now. Do you want to hear him?
Yes, sir.
Of course, MicroStrategy, as it's now known, really started this crypto treasury company trend that we're seeing now. I know that you broadly are supportive of seeing competitors come out and also raise their own crypto treasuries. But how do you feel about the trend that now it's moving more into altcoins? It's moving away from Bitcoin. Do you think that that's a sustainable setup?
You know, I still think the vast majority of the capital flowing into the space is flowing into Bitcoin. We've gone from about 60 companies capitalizing on Bitcoin to 160 companies just in the past 6 months. So I'm laser-like focused on Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin is digital capital. I think it's going to outperform the S&P index over the indefinite future. And I think it's the clear global monetary commodity in the world right now. So it's the lowest risk, highest return, most straightforward strategy if you want to outperform the S&P and if you want to inject vitality and performance into your balance sheet.
So it sounds like you're not concerned that perhaps the fact that we're seeing these other digital asset treasury companies come to the fore here, expand into altcoins, you're not concerned that that's going to detract attention away from what Strategy is doing.
I think there's an explosion of innovation across the entire crypto economy. And on the margin, it's really good for everybody in the digital asset space right now. I think the big idea is $100 trillion plus of capital in the traditional equity capital markets and traditional credit markets. And what we're focused on is delivering digital asset-backed equity and digital asset-backed credit. And I think those credit instruments and equity instruments are just going to outperform the traditional fiat credit and traditional fiat equity instruments all around. And capital is going to flow into the digital economy due to that.
By the way, David, Michael Saylor, did you see those numbers on the screen? Actually had...
67%. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's the strategy premium, but the value of Bitcoin held is $70 billion. We should correct this. And the diluted market cap of his company is $120 billion.
All right? $120 billion.
$120 wow. billion MicroStrategy right yeah. now. Yeah, so what do you think of his comments there?
Very friendly to what is essentially his competition. He did the thing, which is like, yeah, I'm laser focused on Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin is digital capital. But yeah, there's an explosion of innovation across the crypto industry, and this is good for everyone. It was a very tide lifts all boats kind of stance that he had. It's very not like a Bitcoin maxi of him.
Yeah, very much. I mean, maybe he changes based on the venue. This is Bloomberg, so maybe like very rational on that. But the bigger question is this: okay, is this Treasury meta diminishing or is it over? I'm going to go through some numbers with you, particularly that MNAV premium. So there was a time that good old MicroStrategy was trading. This is the orange line. Look at the orange line. Above 3 from an MNAV premium perspective. Like well above, like not, well, yeah, decently above 3. This was October, November of last year. And then since that time, it has been on a decline. There's some periods of flatness here, but it's basically at a local low, let's say, of 1.5. X MNAV premium at this point in time. And if you look at the Ethereum treasury companies, which of course they're brand new, but we do have some MNAV premium stats, it's actually very low, lower than MicroStrategy. Mm. So you've got SBET, and there's some different reports on this. Well, you know, the Strategic ETH Reserve has a different MNAV premium, but this is showing an MNAV premium just above 1. Okay, so valued not much more than its underlying. I think the Strategic ETH Reserve shows something similar, maybe a little bit higher. Tom Lee's entity, 1.35. Okay, some of these other ones, and that's the highest of the ETH treasury companies. Actually, one of these is under 1 at this point in time. It's, I think it's the number 7th largest ETH treasury company. So they actually are about 0.7 MNAV. So they're trading under their MNAV premium. And maybe this is related, but they offered their first ever Ether dividend to those with stock. So basically, they'll pay you a dividend equal to 0.05% of the share in cash or in Ether. You actually collect that if you're a shareholder in Ether. And they were doing this basically to say like, hey, like this, you know, we shouldn't be valued under our book value. You're getting dividends for this. Like market, you should... at least give us an MNAV of 1, if not an MNAV higher than that. So MNAV premiums are collapsing, it looks like, at least at, you know, locally. And some people are saying, that's it. You know, the treasury play is over. We had MicroStrategy, now ETH enter, and we're not going to see premiums again. And that's going to be a bearish indicator because not as much buying will happen on the treasury institutional side. What do you make of this?
The MNAV premium collapsing down to 1 is what's supposed to happen. That's just the market doing its normal thing of all of these treasury companies are supposed to be milking their premium to be able to put more crypto assets on their balance sheet. And they do that as much as they can until they can't do that anymore. Like the MNAV premium is why people have kind of like jokingly called this stuff perpetual motion. Like the energy to fund the perpetual motion runs out when the MNAV premium collapses to 1. And then it gets a little bit harder. So like all of the treasury companies, I feel like have been in this kind of like tutorial island, like the beginner mode, easy mode, while they have this MNAV premium. And then once it runs out, actually the real game starts of like, okay, now how do you do this? Now that you don't have this MNAV premium, now that the market is a little bit more rational, now you have to figure out how to get more ETH on the balance sheet. So what's your next move now? This has been according to plan. MNAV premiums, we're always going to go to 1. Not only this, they are supposed to fluctuate between being higher and then also being at 1. And right now, during periods of like we're worried about the AI bubble. We're worried about the economy and the inflation and the jobs, jobs reports. So it makes sense that the MNAV premium has approached lower levels of froth, more closer to market rationality. And like maybe they go back up, but like there's nothing inherently wrong about finding its way back to just complete rationality.
So do you think it's over? Or do you think there's some more juice in the treasury side of things?
No, dude. I think it's like as the S&P and QQQ reach all-time highs, NVIDIA goes back up. Like the trend is across all markets is good right now. And I've said this like a few roll-ups ago. It's just like the trend feels very good. I'm happy to have these like normal pullbacks. Inflation is going to scare people. The jobs report is going to scare people. Like whatever. So long as just like let's keep the trend intact. They'll reinflate in the future. They'll go back up. Maybe they don't really have the same level of like main character focus that they had. And so maybe MNAV premiums are just fundamentally more modest moving forward. So like 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, maybe. I can't really think of like why this would be really bad. This just seems healthy.
I kind of agree. And I think they could spike back up. And I also think Tom Lee is still dead serious. I mean, his velocity of accumulation, yes. I think he's still dead serious in targeting 5%. And, you know, I think he's going to find a way to do that or get something close to that. So I don't think it's over for the treasury meta this cycle. At some point it will be, but it still seems early to me. Let's talk about how early we are, though, in, you know, the total crypto cycle. This is a fantastic table I saw from CoinGlass. These are, David, these are 30 bull market peak indicators. All right. And this is looking at things historically of how things have played out in previous crypto bull cycles and what those top indicators have been. What I like about this is there's 30. So you look at a whole bunch in an aggregated view, and that's what they do on CoinGlass as well. And then it's also just like, it's kind of what's happened at previous times. So if you believe that this market will play out as previous crypto markets have played out, which I think that's still my base case. Like, I don't see why this time is different. It's certainly not looking different. We're getting many of the similar things that we've seen, patterns we've seen in previous crypto bull cycles. This is what this looks like. So do any of these metrics, like, you know, like what do you think of when you see some of these metrics? Do any of them, are they things that you track?
Yeah, well, some of them are just kind of like a blast from the past. It was like, oh, I remember looking at like the Puel multiple and of course, Eric Wall's Bitcoin Rainbow chart. MV, yep. RV, like all of these things I remember individually learning about one by one over the years. It's kind of cool to see it all in one spot so you can kind of view all of them. You know, what's that line? Like all models are wrong and some are useful. And I think we're just making them in aggregate more useful by putting them all in the same spot and kind of evaluating them in uniform, in unity. I think it's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is cool. There's a ton here. So we'll include a link in the show notes if you guys want to go over here. But yeah, you mentioned a few. The Bitcoin rainbow charts in here. I know you're a big fan of that. The simplicity of that. Okay. Uh-huh. We're at about 60% of our way to that being a bull market peak you should think about selling. Just that one metric alone.
Yeah.
We've got the MVRV score, which we talked about, which is kind of like, you know, how long are the buyers holding for, or the long-term buyers, are they starting to sell? You got Bitcoin bubble index, Bitcoin dominance, all of these all put together. And what you get actually is of these 30, zero of these 30 indicators.
Not one of these should cause you alarm.
Not one of them have hit the sell signal. Not one of them are in the red. And like, you know, there are a few that are somewhat close, but pretty much like the majority are like 60% or under. And so
there are a few that are somewhat close, and then there are a handful that are just nowhere. They're close to zero.
Yeah. So we're not in red territory at all from these long-term indicators. And what should you be doing this type of market? You should be holding.
Yeah.
If you can, maybe you should be buying more. You should be buying the dip. I think that's my base case, man.
If you're aggressive, you're buying. I think it's totally fine to also just hold.
Yeah, you could totally hold. Just don't do margin. Just don't do margin.
Just don't.
That's all.
We'll never
never
do margin.
Never do margin.
Don't do what I do.
That's one indicator for you. Also, another one that I saw was somewhat good here is Nick Carter posted this, but this is a report from Galaxy Research, which is the amount of lending in crypto right now. Okay, so the amount of
the credit
this
markets.
Is CeFi lending, crypto markets, CeFi lending, and you can see right now in the second quarter 2025. It is about half of its peak. Last peak was 2022, Q1 2022, mm-hmm. right before we had the major bear market, the you know what. All right, and that was at its peak. It was above 35. It was closing in on almost $40 billion. Right now, we're just at, what, $16, $17 billion?
Mm-hmm.
So that's
Tether is so much of that.
Yeah, Tether is
insane.
A lot of that.
That's
yeah,
insane.
So I mean, the lending markets in crypto are looking kind of healthy. They're not looking toppy. Right. They're not looking peaky. That's another thing you could look at.
Basically, this means that like people's lines of credit are just modest. People are not borrowing a lot.
And then you got stuff like this. So this was a report that Nick Jarcy highlighted from the Bank of America, the Bank of America Global Fund Manager survey. Okay. And of all the Bank of America Global Fund Managers, 75% of them own zero crypto right now. 0%.
Nice.
All right.
Nice.
6% own two or less. But 75% of them don't own crypto at this point in time.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I'm in New York, and so I talk to a lot of like asset managers when I'm in my travels with normies outside of the crypto world.
Yeah, yeah.
And like most frequently, like they're like, yeah, I don't care about crypto. And then I ask like, okay, what kind of like asset manager are you? And they're like the big ones that trade tiny amounts of bips because they have like people's pensions. And so they can't think about Bitcoin.
So I guess you're not going to listen to this on Burning Man, but we got an episode with Eric Peters that's coming out on Monday.
I'm very sad. I'm very sad that I missed that. And then I'm also sad that I'm not going to hear that for 10 days.
It's a great episode. Love Eric Peters. So he's an institutional investor. He's kind of behind the scenes, probably the biggest crypto institutional influencer allocated that most people have never heard of.
Institutional influencer.
Like, honestly, and that influencing happens in like different settings.
Totally.
You know, it's like Zoom calls and phone calls and text messages, stuff we don't see. Yeah. Anyway, his take was, guess what? The institutions haven't even arrived yet. Because when he thinks of institutional money, he's thinking of sovereign wealth funds. He's thinking of pensions. And he goes through this story of basically 2021, they were all getting set up to buy crypto. They're like, they had these teams of like 15 people. They're going to like go into crypto big. And then 2022 happened, blew it all up.
And they all got scared.
They all, oh, it's dead. It must be dead. And now the US regulatory regime is against it. It's dead. And they went in complete hibernation mode and they got caught offsides and they still haven't rebuilt those teams. All right.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at this, do you know, Norway Sovereign Wealth Fund? They just increased their Bitcoin holdings. Okay. Like they just doubled. And I was like, oh, that's cool. Norway, you know, it's a sovereign wealth fund.
Let's go Norway. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what they're buying though? It's like MicroStrategy and Circle, dude. And it's just a tiny sliver and it's not even an ETF. It's not actual crypto. Who knows? Maybe it's because their regulatory apparatus doesn't allow them to. Maybe the kind of the risk managers, when they float this up the chain, you know, it's just still too risky. It's just, they're offsides on this. Pensions are offsides.
Are they buying MicroStrategy and Circle because those are sufficiently large that they're in an index? Or are they buying that because they want the crypto exposure?
No, they're buying it for the crypto exposure. This was exactly Eric Peters' point. He's like, that's why you're seeing stuff like Circle go crazy, because institutional allocators they're nibbling at it. And they've been caught offsides on this whole crypto trade. So they haven't even entered.
So when people who have like $1 trillion in assets nibble at Circle, it pumps by like 3x off the IPO price. Yeah.
It's that kind of thing.
Right.
Anyway,
well, why don't you nibble at my bags, please?
He said they will. They will. So you just gotta, you know, be in the market and wait a little bit. Gemini's coming into the market. We got this coming up next. They've filed for their place on the NASDAQ. How do the financials look? What's this going to do? Also, New York, your state, David, is trying its absolute best to not become the crypto capital of the world. We'll talk about that. And the Fed?
Why do you think I'm not in New York right now?
The Fed is getting bullish on crypto right now. There's a recent speech I want to tell you about as well. All this and more. But first, we want to thank our sponsors, Frax, some of the best yield in DeFi. It's like Circle, Athena, Maker all had a stablecoin baby. It's a beautiful system. Go check out Frax.
In the wild west of DeFi, stability and innovation are everything, which is why you should check out Frax Finance, the protocol revolutionizing stablecoins, DeFi, and Rolex. The core of Frax Finance is Frax USD, which is backed by BlackRock's institutional Biddle Fund. Frax designed Frax USD for best-in-class yields across DeFi, T-bills, and carry trade returns all in one. Just head to Frax.com, then stake it to earn some of the best yields in DeFi. Want even more? Bridge your Frax USD over to the Fraxtl Layer 2 for the same yield plus Fraxtl points, and explore Fraxtl's diverse Layer 2 ecosystem with protocols like Curve, Convex, and more, all rewarding early adopters. Frax isn't just a protocol. It's a digital nation, powered by the FXS token and governed by its global community. Acquire FXS through Frax.com or your go-to DEX, stake it, and help shape Frax Nation's future. Ready to join the forefront of DeFi? Visit Frax.com now to start earning with Frax USD and staked Frax USD. And for Bankless listeners, you can use Frax.com/r/Bankless when bridging to Fraxtl for exclusive Fraxtl perks and boosted rewards.
Gemini, one of the oldest crypto exchanges founded by the Winklevi, of course, Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, publicly filed for an IPO to list its shares on the NASDAQ under the ticker GEMI. So the leading underwriters are banks like Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, and Cantor. Number of shares and their price have not been disclosed yet, but nonetheless, the Winklevi are pushing to make Gemini a publicly traded company. There's also a loan agreement with Ripple revealed that it gave it $75 million of credit for extra liquidity for its IPO. Potentially extend that to $150. I don't know what that means. What does that mean?
I don't know. I guess they're just, I don't know, something between Ripple and Gemini, just providing some additional capital here.
Okay. Gemini will operate through two entities, the Gemini Trust in New York for its regulated services, and then Moonbase in Florida, where Gemini will transition most of its users. Because, of course, New York is the most hostile state to crypto under the BitLicense rules. As we are about to see when we talk about the new proposed, this is not yet law, but it's being proposed. And the reason why we're talking about it is how ridiculous it is. 0.2% tax on digital asset transactions inside of New York. And so this is Assembly Bill 8966, introduced by the Democratic Assembly member Phil Steck. The bill notes that funding from crypto tax sales would be used to expand a substance abuse prevention and intervention program to schools in upstate New York. It would include the sale and transfer of any crypto or NFTs, CryptoPunks, Pudgy Penguins, any of those, 0.2% tax. If you just transfer a Pudgy, you transfer a $10,000 Pudgy and you owe 0.2% off of something you didn't, you're just transferring it? Absolutely ridiculous.
I don't think so. I don't think just transferring it couldn't be. It would have to follow.
It would include the sale and transfer of any crypto or NFTs.
That's what our notes say, but it's got to be sale. It can't be just a 0.2% tax. Even if it's just on sales, though, this is like your tax situation in crypto is already more like complicated enough.
Right.
And now New York State is going to add like, why?
They don't
why
realize
digital assets?
How incredibly complicated that makes everything.
Right. And this, well, yeah. No, maybe they do realize that. Maybe they don't care. I don't know. They just, why digital assets? Yeah. Why digital assets in particular? That's the question. It's like New York State is trying to not become the crypto state, trying not to become the crypto capital of the world. And this
I think you see like a lot of like, I don't know, crypto socialists out there who are like voting or anti-crypto socialists, who are voting for like Zohran Mamdani, who are like, yeah, let's get the crypto bros to pay for our substance abuse programs. That sounds great. I don't know any crypto people, so they can pay for that.
Yeah.
It's also worth saying that like New York, especially New York City, is the most tax prosperous location in all of America. They have so much tax income. And the reason why, I'm not saying like New York's, they have some problems with allocating all that capital.
Yes.
They don't have a budget problem. They have a capital allocation. They can't figure out how to appropriately spend the money. And like then you have people like the socialists like Zohran Mamdani coming in who would be like, you know what? We need to fund more stuff because look at all the broken stuff around us. So let's tax more people. And
tax the monkey JPEGs.
Tax the monkey JPEGs so we can fund more stuff. When we realize we have so much money, we just can't figure out actually how to spend it correctly.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, you got other states, and maybe this is a state that you might consider, exiting to. You could do Balaji Srinivasan. You could use your agency to exit New York, and you could go to Wyoming because that is a crypto-friendly state. And this week, this is actually pretty surprising to me. They launched the first stablecoin issued by a U.S. state. The state of Wyoming did this. They're saying it can be used to fund public services. It's a revenue driver, and it's also kind of a hallmark of Wyoming innovation. And you could actually do this. So this was in the Genius Bill. I don't know if you remember, we talked about this very briefly, but I'd sort of forgotten about this. States can actually issue their own stablecoins. So every state of the 50 states in the union, they could have their own like branded stablecoin if they want to, and that revenue can be used for public goods or whatever else they want. I'm not sure practically how commercially useful this is or how many more states will actually like go do this. It does have to stay under like $10 billion or so. So it's more like an innovation sandbox. But this is just Wyoming saying like, we are welcoming the crypto industry here. We're welcoming crypto people here. And by the way, we got our own stablecoin. Kind of cool.
That's kind of cool. Going up a level higher to the White House, the executive director of crypto in the White House, Bo Hines, has left to go to Tether. So they're going from the White House to Tether. Served as the executive director of Trump's White House Crypto Council until just last week, where he announced that he's going to work in the private sector. So what is he going to work at Tether? He's going to lead and coordinate Tether's U.S. strategy and expansion efforts, advise on digital asset policies and compliance for the U.S. market, cultivate relationships with policymakers and regulators, and help oversee Tether's continued investments in U.S. infrastructure. So Tether, with the passing of the Genius Bill, wants to make inroads into United States, because they're the foreign stablecoin. They would like to also become the domestic stablecoin. And Bo Hines, the guy who's the executive, previously the executive director of Trump's White House Crypto Council, is going to go help him do that. Who would be better? Who would be better than that?
Of course. I mean, there's a bit of a revolving door going on here for sure, right? It's like, I don't know how you get out of that or get past that. What's really interesting...
Is the revolving door a United States America native term? Like, well... European or like South American listeners know what that term is?
I guess revolving door just means somebody gets a job in government, right? And they're not making as much money, but they gain kind of influence and the ability to kind of, you know, make phone calls in government and get companies what they want. And then after their government job, they go back into industry where they can basically make lots of money, or they go to a lobbyist group or something like that.
And they use their network and their influence.
Right. And that's essentially what's happening. Like that's how the game works. I don't know. There's some elements of this is just like how the game works. I don't know how you accomplish things in DC or actually like what the other option that crypto tried, which is just to kind of like lay down and die and not be at the table. And they were definitely on the menu. Right. And I think in 2023, 2024, the entire industry realized it had to be present. So it is. Mm-hmm. And this is the type of thing you see. But what's interesting is Tether, David, last quarter, they bought more treasuries. They bought $8 billion worth of treasuries. Okay, so only six other countries, sovereign countries, bought more treasuries last quarter than Tether did. All right, they are a quasi nation state with respect to the amount of treasuries they buy from Bessent. They are a customer of Bessent, and so it's kind of, you can see the interlinking here between, you know, like government and private sector in this way.
In a different part of Capitol Hill, the SEC is investigating the CEO of WFLFI, the Trump World Liberty Financial treasury company. So we talked about this last week. The World Liberty Financial has a treasury company coming online. The information reported that the SEC investigated John Isaac, the CEO, sometimes referred to as the president of Alt 5 Sigma, World Liberty Financial Treasury Company. There were accusations that Isaac and Alt 5 Sigma misrepresented earnings by overstating revenue and understating expenses to boost the company's financial results, which, I mean, Trump does this and has done this in the past.
Look, if they did this, though, if they did this, right, and they could prove this, then the SEC is the regulator to hold them accountable for this. This is what we should be like striving for. If we don't see this, if this type of thing gets pardoned, repealed, if the dogs are called off, right, that's evidence of corruption, basically, in the government.
Totally.
We don't want to, like, we had a very crypto unfavorable government that was like corrupt in different ways. We don't want to swing to the other side of having like a grifting, fully corrupt government that just allows this
crime,
type of thing
to happen. Crime is still crime. We don't want crime season.
It's really hard to have a nuanced conversation about this stuff, right? It's like, but I'm going to be watching this one to see what the Trump White House actually does with this, to see, you know, whether we've gone too far in the other direction here. Speaking of going far in the direction of crypto, which I am very supportive of, this is the Fed turning bullish on crypto. So this is a speed.
Our Federal Reserve.
Yeah. Jerome Powell's Fed, the same thing. That same Fed we were talking about earlier. This is Michelle Bowman. She gave a speech. Now, what's her position? She is the vice chair for supervision of the Fed. All right. So she kind of, I think she reports to Powell, or she's one of two vice chairs that are under Powell right now. And she's the vice chair for supervision. She said this in a speech, I believe at a crypto conference, that the U.S. is at a crossroads and must embrace crypto and new technologies to stay ahead of financial innovation. She said regulators need to abandon an overly cautious mindset and essentially double down on crypto. And you know that whole Fed bank supervision, that department within the Fed that made banks feel like it was very risky to do anything with crypto? She completely gutted that. So that's no longer, this bank supervision program is no longer in effect. And she's easing all the restrictions there. And she also added this. This is what I thought you'd really like. She added that Fed staff should hold small amounts of crypto to better understand the technology. She said, he's comparing it to learning to ski by actually putting on skis.
That's so good.
Right?
God, we've been saying that for so long.
The last executive office basically banned anyone who owned crypto to be a regulator of crypto.
Right. Right. And so if you were bullish crypto, and say you were in government office, the SEC, and you were like, oh, wait, Bitcoin is actually pretty dope.
Yeah.
I would like to own some of this to hand down Bitcoin to my kids. You would have to quit. And then all the people who are inherently are left at the SEC are people who don't give a fuck
about
crypto and don't see the value in it. Or
all the regulators, the entire executive branch. And this is the thing we're saying. You're self-selecting for people who like are bearish, hate crypto, don't understand it. And this is the opposite of that. Now, by the way, we're not advocating that you shouldn't have full transparency over your holdings and that kind of, you can't trade this type of thing, right? You know, maybe should be locked in a trust or something. We should have full transparency and visibility. But to put out a blanket
implementation details.
Yeah, but to put out a blanket rule in the White House that if you own crypto, you can't do anything to regulate crypto. Right. That's like the what I'm saying.
The number one way to onboard someone and get them into crypto and see crypto, the value of crypto, is
just give them some crypto.
Just give them some crypto.
Use an airdrop.
And they will become a crypto person. It works. It's the highest success rate I've ever discovered.
Yeah, I totally agree. And what's amazing to me is how 180 we've come from like 12 to 18 months a year ago when we're in a completely... Now, this is somebody in the Fed saying, hey, everyone in the Fed should own some crypto so you guys understand it. Go use some stable coins, you know, go grab some Ether, grab some Bitcoin. So very cool from
Ether,
that perspective.
Ether.
Yeah, definitely. All right, guys, we're going to end it there. Got to let you know, crypto is risky. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west and David is headed towards Burning Man. This is the frontier.
That's west. That is west.
That's west. He's literally going west. It's not for everybody, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless Journey. Thanks a lot.